Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Inside the Football Business with Neil Stratton and Justin Van Fulpen as we talk about the business of the game of football. As always, with me, it's Neil Stratton. How are you doing this morning, Neil?
Doing great, Justin. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, for sure. And we wanted to, you know, talk a little bit about the CBS Sports article that talked about, you know, the potential of the NFL doing a developmental league or a combine or, you know, academy, excuse me. That was from Jason Lockenfor, formerly of the NFL Network and now at CBS Sports. You know, you had wrote a piece there on, you know, as far as inside the league in regards to, hey, what the validity of this would be. And kind of initially, what were your thoughts of that? And then I'll kind of, share mine and we'll kind of see, you know, see where that kind of leads us.
Well, I think one of the sexiest topics, especially within the game, with, again, people that work in the game and around the game, and that goes for the media as well as, people on the management side and even coaches and especially players and agents, is the idea of kind of an NFL minor league akin to what the NBA has. Certainly not as extensive as what Major League Baseball has, but maybe something that gives – players one more chance post college to work in a football environment, and when I say football, I mean traditional outdoors football with, you know, kickoffs and punts and all those kind of things, not indoor arena style football. And that topic is so popular that we get, you know, probably one alternative NFL football league that pops up every spring, or they're kind of like the weeds, you know, in everyone's front yard. And these ideas will pop up, and sometimes they'll actually make it to a payday, to a kickoff, but most of the times they don't. Most of the times they have paid tryouts around the nation. There's much pomp and circumstance and lots of hot air and that kind of thing, but it never really gets off the ground. But none of these games had the stamp of the Shield. And the Shield, of course, is what separates the men from the boys and really makes it a much more legitimate situation. And maybe one of these days there will be an NFL minor league, but the story that Lockenfor wrote, although well written and although pretty well sourced, and obviously he's talked to a lot of people and it's an idea that a lot of people that are not on the operations side of things get excited about, it's no more closer to happening than it was 4 years ago or 10 years ago in my mind. And the reason why is, ultimately, number one, I mean, just to get on the technical side, it's going to have to be something that's collectively bargained, and this CBA doesn't run out until 2020. So that's the big thing that kind of throws a big roadblock in front of everything. But beyond that, ultimately, you've got to sell this thing, and you've got to make money with it. And the NFL has the Midas touch when it comes to making money and all those things. And so it's possible you could, especially initially when – with the NFL's marketing machine behind it, it's probably something that could be kind of attractive, and they can make it look like, hey, this is where the U.S. play, and it's going to be in a real football environment, and maybe they could take it to cities that have always expressed interest in an NFL team and give them an opportunity to show that, hey, how badly do you want it, and that kind of thing. And there are always markets they could find that have an open football stadium. But ultimately, until you can really make this into a moneymaker, there's no reason to have a minor league when you've got the world's best minor league already running, and that's college football, especially at the Power 5 level. So while it's exciting, and while every smallish, newer agent out there with a dozen players calling them every day saying, hey, what have you heard, gets titillated by this, it's not something that's really got legs until there's a lot more meat on the bone. And I think it's going to take a lot more than an article written in the off season when there's not a whole lot to write about football-wise to make this more of a reality, even though it sounds like a great idea. And so many people, again, on the operations side, the front office people, the coaches, certainly the players, and especially the agents, are really excited about it. So although it's a neat article and something cool to read in June, I don't think it's anything more than that. And despite the fact that a lot of people are really excited about it, I hate to be a party pooper. It's just, it's a real long shot.
Yep. And you know, to sum your point, the you know, the collective bargaining, you know, agreement, like you said, that runs out 2020. But here's my thing on the flip side of this is that, one, the owners are going to have to be able to, regardless if they want to keep Roger Goodell and, you know, far as with the power and different things like that, the HGA testing, the different things that, you know, the owners want to be able to get in that, they're going to need some olive branch to be able to get to the players' union. And this is where they can say, hey, we're going to give more players jobs, you know, and isn't this great for, you know, the NFLPA? You'll have, you know, more members, and you can go say that, hey, you've created, you know, jobs as far as for players. So I think that's one thing that, hey, you know, the owners could use that as a bargaining chip there. You know, and number two is that you're right on a standpoint that Power Five is, you know, the true minor league of the NFL, and it always will be. The problem is what we're getting is that the development of quarterbacks, and I think this was seen with the Philadelphia Eagles jumping all the way up to the number two spot, is they've seen what I've seen is that you look in the next 2 years in the college football, and there's not a lot of pro-style quarterbacks that are going to come in there. And, you know, the college football game is—it's a different game now. It's spread offenses, it's shotgun, it's, you know, the tackles and their you know, pass sets and different things like that. We're talking about different hash marks. So we're talking about the true star of the NFL, and that's the quarterback position. That is a hard time being developed. And the same thing where Lock and Fort brings out in regards to an academy standpoint, and I think maybe that makes a little bit more sense, is that, like, he brought out, hey, this guy, you know, guys have been on the UPS truck, and then boom, they jump it off that and go to a Tuesday morning workout because, you know, a guy had a running back injury there, and they needed a running back to come in there and, you know, practice, and the guy hasn't been in a football shape or a football playing standpoint there. Now, you know, now could they then expand the rosters and go from 53-man roster to a 56-man roster and a 12-man roster, you know, practice squad? Yeah, you know, maybe that's how they're going to be able to, you know, appease the NFLPA, because there has been talk, you know, about that, and be able to give more players, you know, jobs. But the thing is the developmental stuff that the NFL Europe was able to do, you know, in regards to the players that came out of that. Now, again, the NFL owners stopped that because they were losing $13 million a year on that, and they didn't see the value in that. But with the NFL trying to be more of a global reach, and we saw the German wide receiver get drafted, you know, maybe an academy style standpoint makes more sense and is less cost than a true, hey, we're the NFL D League there. I think there's at some point, it's not going to be this year, it's not going to be next year, it's not going to be probably 2 years from now. But in the future, I really think that there'll be something, I think, more of an academy style thing that the NFL will invest with. We've seen them do that with kind of the NFL Europe Academy, you know, over there to try to help guys in OCU Manura, you know, kind of has had that, all of the league offices there. So I think there's going to be something, and I think Lock and Four brings up, I think the academy, I think, is going to be more likely than a true minor league like the NBA D League or Major League Baseball's minor league system.
Well, you make a lot of great points, and Justin, you and I are football guys. We really get into this kind of stuff, and it's exciting to think of the idea of developing talent and making players that weren't quite there into players that can hang around the league for 5 or 6 years. That is, it makes good sense from a football standpoint. I just think that ultimately you can buy off the NFLPA by expanding the practice squads, which is kind of what they did. You can buy them off by expanding the off-season rosters, which is what they did, you know, going from 80 to 90 and going practice squads from 5 to 10. That gives you more players that are actually on rosters. Now, it's different from being on 53, obviously, but ultimately, I think the players that really move the needle are the guys that get drafted in the first round and the really big talents. And unless they can make this something where it's almost cost neutral, then I think the people that make the real decisions, the money decisions in New York, are probably not going to go for this idea. I think it's got a lot of, there are a lot of good things you could do with it if you really, again, attach it to the Shield, and perhaps the guys that are playing in the minor league have, you know, if they're let's say designated for the league by the Saints, if you put their team logo on one side of their helmet, maybe the Fleur de Lis on the other side, you know, where teams can, where fans can really look and say, hey, that's a guy that's going to maybe be with the Saints someday. Then maybe you kind of have that AAA farm team aspect of things that makes it attractive. I haven't studied enough about how well the NBA D League does from a ticket standpoint. I haven't studied the way minor league baseball does from a ticket standpoint to really know enough about the economics of it. I know that at the minor league baseball level, the real winners in ticket sellers have been the ones that almost make the game on the field a sideshow. I mean, they're doing stuff in the stands at all times, and they've got elaborate play areas for kids, and they've got all these kind of things. And I don't, you know, again, you have to find, I guess, cities that are willing to come in and embrace a team that way. Now, if you take the game off the field and you just make it academies and kind of follow the model that the CGS All-Star Game has done, and you make it strictly about evaluation and not about trying to sell tickets, maybe that saves you some money. Again, I don't know if that's something the NFL is exploring or not with these academies. I mean, the one thing that's kind of in their favor is that there are so many well-established combine prep facilities that are looking for things to do in March, April, May, kind of once combine training winds down. Maybe that's something that could have legs. There certainly are a lot of training facilities out there that are on a pretty grand scale, like what you have with IMG Academy. Again, until the NFL kind of leads the way on this and really kind of gets its feet in the water and starts walking and showing what direction they want to go, it's fun speculation, but I don't know that it's anything more than that.
Yeah, so it's definitely something that's interesting and something that I think we're going to see more talk about, you know, down the road and, you know, in the future, because it's something that people, I think, do believe in, as Lock and Fork had put out, you know, had sourced in his article, and we'll see, see with definitely different things that go on there. So some interesting things on, inside the league of this week, you know, that you have done. And again, listeners, if you're not a subscriber of Inside the League, make sure you go check that out and subscribe, to that. You know, kind of one thing that regards to breakdowns of the NFL draft, you have done it by training facilities, and then you've also kind of saw what stood out to you in regards to the NFL draft and guys, you know, agencies or, you know, as far as SRAs that were signed there. So kind of what, you know, on both of those subjects there, kind of what kind of stood out to you in regards to the trainers and the training breakdown, and as well as the agents per se themselves?
Well, what's interesting to me, we'll start with the trainers first, is there's been a bit of consolidation with the major facilities. You're seeing some outliers, like, for example, Jalen Ramsey, who trained with his father. You're seeing you know, Taylor Decker, who trained with the Charles Bentley because he had developed that relationship at Ohio State. But outside of the handful of outliers and outside of the handful of agencies that kind of have a proprietary training facilities, the big trainers are dominating right now. You have Exos, formerly Athletes Performance, which has – I think five facilities across the nation, maybe six. I can count on my fingers. Four of those, let's see, five of those are in the top ten. Their San Diego location, their Florida location, their Arizona location, and their Los Angeles location all finished in the top ten. The San Diego location was number one. That's somewhat interesting because there's been a bit of transition from the Arizona location, which used to be probably the biggest one in the game and really the destination training facility for everyone who was slated to go in the top 30, 40 picks, to where it's now more the San Diego location, and even to some degree the Florida location. The Florida location, which is located in the Pensacola area, Pensacola, Florida, used to be known more as a place where if you had suffered a major injury, but you're an elite player, you could go there and rehab and kind of train at the same time. I think more players are seeking to go there just for the training, not as much because they're hurt. Whereas with the San Diego location, you're seeing a lot more quarterbacks, receivers go there. The receivers, because they follow the quarterbacks. And they're becoming more and more known as that kind of place where you can really go hone things. You've seen, I guess, maybe some slippage from the kind of, I don't know if I want to say a la carte trainers, but the specialists like the George Whitfields, which really used to dominate. But they were mainly just training quarterbacks. You know, this year, Carson Wentz, Jared Goff weren't going to Whitfield, and so it was less of, you know, he didn't have that marquee guy that he could really kind of market off of, and so he's not showing up in these lists the way that he used to. D1's sports training, which is their Orlando location, benefited from working with Chuck Smith this year. Chuck Smith is an incredible recruiter and a really good trainer, and he's got a great name in the business, and he's really excelled with pass rushers and the like. And that partnership they developed really built some roots down in South Florida and really kind of flowered. And so that was a good move there. So after the top 10, you start seeing a lot of strong facilities, excuse me, that just maybe didn't have the first rounders. The first rounders will project you up the propel you up the list when it comes to this. So Michael Johnson Performance, Fit Speed, which is a real riser, Traction Sports, which is really kind of come on strong, based in Louisiana. These are all facilities that had good years too and are kind of moving up. But again, you got the domination really by the excess facilities, by XPE, Tony Volani's facility, which came in number three, really impressive. T. Bomarito's facility, BPS, was number four, which is really impressive as well. So, again, the favorites, the top facilities are really setting themselves apart from pretty much from the pack, I think, there. On the other hand, among the big agencies and looking at the draft, it was kind of a different story because you had so much of a fracturing of the, I don't know how you want to describe it, but the bigger firms had, they did well. They're always going to do well, but there were 11 firms that had players in the top in the first round that were not in the top 30 firms as you go by value points, which is kind of how we grade it, across the last 10 years. Rock Nation, which has kind of come on strong and has, Jay-Z's star power behind it, which is, so I guess it's not a big surprise that they were able to land a top 10 pick. But you've got ProSource Sports, which is based in Louisiana, another firm that has really come on strong lately and has always been a solid kind of middle-class firm. But they moved up and had a great year. National Sports Agency based in St. Louis, which has always been, again, a solid middle-class firm, been around since the dawn of man, but they haven't really moved up into the first round. You had Alliance Management that had Ezekiel Elliott, so that was kind of their one shining star for the draft. MS World here in Houston, which had a William Jackson. You've got Vanguard with Joey Brannion, which had a great year, and a number of other agencies that you don't normally associate with the first round, but maybe we will going forward. There's normally so much domination by the CAAs and the Athletes First and the Octagons and Priorities and all those facilities that are always thought of as having first rounders. This year there was a little bit more of a drawback from some of those bigger firms with kind of an advance by some of the smaller firms. Why is that? It's kind of hard to say. It's kind of got a lot to do with, I think, the fact that this was a little bit of an oddity because it seemed like there were some prior relationships between agencies and players that they were able to develop. This especially takes hold among players that leave early because, again, there's less time for maybe a big firm to come in kind of late and really romance and recruit a player. And a player that already had that prior relationship, in some cases before they even went to college, that just kind of gives that agency the nod. And sometimes those agencies want the big ones. So, you know, as we always say, I know it's a cliche, but change is the one constant when it comes to this business. You're not seeing it as much on the training side, but on the agency side, it's really happening. There's a lot more fracturing of the top players and where they're going. And despite the fact that CAA had so many players they signed this year, there were a lot more that made it into the first round that weren't with the big firms, and that's what we saw this year.
Do you think this is a trend or just an anomaly, just a one-year spike?
I think it's going to become a trend because we're seeing more and more players, you know, even though the NFL tries to stop it and they've changed the way they did the draft review board and all those kind of things, I think that it's just going to continue to have more and more younger players coming in. And as the younger players come in, they seem to have preferences among facilities that weren't your traditional ones. And I know I sat on a panel in February with a lot of major agencies. We were at in Los Angeles at a law school there. And the one thing they all said was it's so hard to evaluate these juniors. And so hard to find out. It's one thing for them to, you know, make headlines on the field and be exciting players, but where do they really fit into the order? Where do scouts really, how do they feel about them? And the funny thing is scouts don't really know until pretty late in the process. And they find out things, you know, injury-wise and maybe character-wise and what have you, and they wind up taking them. And even when they don't find things out, sometimes they'll take a player because they're sexy, and then come to find out they weren't quite the player that they didn't really develop the way they thought they might. So I think this is going to continue for that reason. Also because it's becoming so much more of a money-driven thing, and you're going to and I know that there are some agencies because of the way the economy has performed and who's backing them that may not be as big a players in the 2017 draft because they just don't have the resources. And it's a lot easier maybe for a smaller firm to go in and either get that loan or maybe find that one backer that can help them through one draft and they can score a big player and then hopefully use that as kind of their cornerstone, their foundation as they build forward and, you know, recruit in other areas. So I think this is something that we may continue to see, and there may be further fracturing. It's the kind of thing that's, again, for a geek like myself, it's kind of fun to watch this stuff and see how it develops. So we'll see if this is a trend that takes hold, but it's certainly something that we've seen so far.
Gotcha. And, you know, what about the United States? So we hadn't talked about this before the show, but just kind of something that I thought about. What about the new class? Have you heard, you know, how many will sit for the exam coming up? And, you know, last year, obviously, there wasn't many guys that had passed the exam. Do we see that, you know, do we see a smaller guys, you know, trying to get into the business? And would that be an effect as well?
Well, my guess is that there'll be a bumper crop of they may be running out of seats at the hotel when they go to take the test this year because so many – they had a normal-sized class last year, only 71 passed, whereas usually it's about 150 thereabouts, about double that. So you're going to get probably around 200 outstanding candidates from who tried to pass last year, plus if they get the normal – number of applicants, which is usually around 250 to 300, you're looking at, I mean, they may have as many as 500 people in there trying to take the test this year. I mean, they really might have some overflow. They might have to be moving to another hotel. Whether or not they keep the test the way it has been in the past is it's not something I'm privy to. They're not real big fans of spreading secrets with me. So I guess we'll only know in a couple months how that goes, and obviously that's something we follow pretty closely. I think there are a lot of contract advisors that kind of felt like they've been ambushed last year because they changed the way they conducted the test. They made the questions a lot harder. They made the questions take a lot more time, and the people that had prepared for the traditional test, which is certainly not easy, but maybe a little bit more straightforward, weren't ready for what they saw when they went and sat, you know, for the test this year. So what will the NFLPA do? I'm not even sure the NFLPA knows right now, but we'll find out here in a couple months.
Gotcha.
I should say 6 weeks.
So, yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how many, new contract advisors. Like you said, it was a low in regards to only a little over 70 that had passed it that would be going into their ability to sign athletes this year. So, kind of the last couple of minutes, some news and notes around the agency business. We saw that NFL agent Vinny Porter, he had been reinstated as to resume his contract career. And then we also saw that LaGrange Sports promotes Joel Siegel to be president of Team Sports. So obviously they had a great year again with 5 first rounders, and he's going to go ahead and take over the whole role of overseeing not just football, but all the team sports there for that French agency there. So a couple of minutes and comments, in regards to those two topics there, Neil.
It's a great move for Joel. Football is always going to be number one for Joel. And what you've seen with Lagardère is a consistency there. While some firms kind of drop off and run out of money or run out of recruiting muscle or can't adapt at times, Joel's really been pretty consistent. It always has, 2 to 3, 3 to 4 players in the first round, and that's really where the money is. And for a big conglomerate like Lagardère, they've got to be happy with that, and I'm sure that's what kind of dictated the move. As far as Vinny Porter, congratulations. I think it was a surprise to a lot of people in the industry. When the news broke at the Senior Bowl last year, 2015, what all had happened, and just kind of reading the story as it was reported, it looked pretty bad, but obviously they were able to get all that worked out, and perhaps it wasn't what it looked like, obviously, and I credit Darren Heitner for his work. He's really carved out a niche as being a pretty effective advocate for people who are fighting the power of the NFLPA, and so congratulations to Vinny. And I guess he'll be back on the recruiting trail. He had developed a pretty good amount of momentum before all this stuff happened. So, yeah, interesting developments on the agency front there.
Yeah, and my, knowing the industry, is what I know, that's going to be something that people are going to negatively recruit against Vinny Porter or whatever happened. But in regards to the rumors of that, and, it was pretty bad, there with him and, another party that was involved, with that kind of that scandal that had popped, like you said, a couple of years ago there. So, definitely interesting, but and it's interesting that it got overturned. I think that mm-hmm. was the surprise there, that the NFLPA would, the independent arbitrator would overturn what the NFLPA had kind of decided there. So I thought that was interesting news that had broke this past week there. So, like I said, we're in June. There's a lot of OTAs, mini camps is started, and then it's going to be a break for the players for about a month before we roll into training camp. So we're not too far away from NFL training camps getting started. And it just seems like we had the Super Bowl, and we're already going to be back at it. Which for guys like me and you, it's a good thing there. So As we, kind of, what do we got going on as far as inside the league, kind of upcoming for next week?
Well, next week we'll continue to kind of delve into the draft and what we saw this year and continue to develop trends. Next week we're hoping to have the total number by position of players that were drafted, signed as undrafted free agents, and made it to tryouts versus the number that were actually signed to standard representation agreements. It's always interesting, at least to me, kind of a nerd about this stuff, how deep the NFL goes into by position versus how many players sign. As you know, there are always more wide receivers and cornerbacks signed to standard representation agreements because there's more of them out there, and they're easier to recruit and all those kind of things. But the NFL is really looking for more guys that are kind of freaky and, unusual, and that usually lends itself more to guys that are big and can run fast or guys that are big and can move their feet, tackles, tight ends. Maybe guards, maybe centers. And I expect that to hold true this year, but we'll go inside the numbers and find out really what the trends look like. So looking forward to that this week. I think it'll be a lot of fun to put that out there.
Well, as always, a great half an hour of football talk, and look forward to next week. And you have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds great. Thanks, Justin.